thanks for tuning in. You are listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. Today, my guest is Don Brightup. He's the author of the 33 and a third book on Asia. He's also the lead singer and songwriter of the band Monkey House. Their sound is very much indebted to Steely Dan. You know, they've worked with some of the same people who are involved with Donald and Co., including Michael Leonard, Drew Zing, Elliot Randall, quite a few others. They've covered Steely Dan songs. What you're actually hearing now is their excellent rendition of Greg Fillengain's Lazy Nina, a song that was originally written by Donald Fagen. But anyway, you know, Don Brightup, you know, he's really one of these people who has had an almost lifelong relationship to the music of Steely Dan and an intricate knowledge of just about everything there is to know. I mean, he literally wrote the book on Asia. So anyway, without further ado, this is my conversation with Don Brightup. Enjoy.
I was riding my bike along my street, my red CCM three-speed bike, in early 73, at which point I would have been 12. And I used to ride around with my transistor radio in the basket of the bike and just have music on constantly, because I had just sort of turned on to like mono AM hit radio. And Reeling in the Years came on, and I'd never heard it before. And I actually pulled the bike over and went like, what the hell is this? Like, even at that age, sort of going, okay, the other tunes are catchy. You know, I like the up-tempo ones. I like the drums. I like whatever. But that song just seemed to be speaking direct. Oh, God made something for me. This is my thing that he made, so I could hear it today while riding my bike, kind of thing. And so, you know, I got curious about those guys right away and, you know, got the first album and have just been, you know, on the edge of my seat for every release since then.
Really? So from the first album you were in, did you get Countdown and Pretzel Logic and Katie, like as they came out pretty much?
I did. Yeah. And, I got more scientific about it as it went on. Like I would, you know, back in the pre-internet days, it was hard to figure when the release date was, particularly the Canadian release date, because it, you know, records didn't always come out the same time worldwide back then. And so I remember doing some research before Katie Lied came out and like being at the record store when it opened that day and wow. And saying, okay, hand it over.
Wow. You know, I can't find anywhere, you know, and I've done pretty extensive research on this stuff, and I can't find anywhere the actual date that Countdown to Ecstasy was released. So I was hoping maybe if you had an old scrapbook.
I don't have
or
that
something.
Particular tidbit. No, I wasn't too scientific about it, but I mean, I find it difficult to separate my own sort of creativity and writing history and history in bands and everything from sort of growing up with the Steely Dan stuff and having my ambition and harmonic palette and idea of what a record should sound like expand as theirs expanded, you know, and the bar just kept getting higher. So by the end of high school, I was sort of like, well, you know, if you want to do anything good, it's got to be perfect. Which
so
was
you kind of took their philosophy as your own, as you.
Yeah, I mean, without you know trying to kind of grab it and run off with it, it just became, you know, the way the Beatles were for maybe the half generation before me. That was the kind of shining example of kind of every category of record making, production and ensemble playing and lyrics and melody and chords and arrangements. So
yeah, and that's kind of how you actually lay out, you know, your Asia book, and we'll get to that. But
yeah,
so in those pre-internet days, you know, when you were getting each album, Was it just the album that you were engaging with, or were you trying to find out other things about the band, you know, any way you could? Like, did you see those Midnight Special, you know, TV appearances by any chance? Like, were you keeping tabs on that stuff? I mean, how did you get your
Yes.
fix? You were such a huge fan, but there was no internet,
Right. Well,
so.
for one thing, there's the lost art of kind of lyric sheets and credits and liner notes that used to actually come with
Right.
albums, which you got to hold a gun to somebody's head to find that stuff out now. So there was that sort of sitting there with the album in your lap, reading and rereading everything. But then, yeah, there was the Midnight Special and all the rock magazines that would occasionally have a little drib or drab about Steely Dan. I mean, there was always that kind of skepticism about them from the sort of rock and hard rock community. Like, are these guys really rock? Are they kind of having us on? But Cream magazine and Circus and Rolling Stone and all that stuff, I was sort of glued to it. Yeah.
Did you get defensive as a fan when you would see, you know, people criticize their, you know, because there are still, they will always be a bit of a divisive band no matter what, it seems. With all the ebbs and flows that have kind of happened throughout the history of Steely Dan, there's always kind of two sides to the, you know.
Yes, yeah, and particularly after they decided that they were just a studio unit and they no longer had kind of an 8x10 with five guys with long hair that kind of looked like a band, then people really got suspicious. What is this? Is this a rock band? Is Steely Dan a guy? Who are these guys? All that stuff. So I just sort of sought out like-minded people and played in bands with them or had jams with them or just late night listening sessions or whatever sort of made me feel like I wasn't alone in my obsession.
As their sound kind of evolved, I mean, were you just along for the ride in terms of, you know, when they started to become jazzier and, you know, writing sort of longer songs, less rocking?
Yeah, well, I feel like I was just about the right age for that evolution to be happening to me as a sort of young budding musician as it happened to them. It started out with a little more decodable kind of pop choruses and song lengths and all that. But I grew up in a house where my dad was a jazz piano obsessed fan of Oscar Peterson and Brubeck and George Shearing and Art Tatum and Bill Evans and all that music was around me as a kid. So I sort of had maybe woken up those pathways in my brain already before I even knew they were there. So when Steely Dan went there and the horns became more of a thing and the harmony got more complex, I was completely ready for it.
Wow.
So Gaucho came out when I was, I guess, 19. And by then I had decided I actually was a musician, so. I think, like a lot of people, the continuity of that musical spirit and that particular menu of ingredients that Donald used just came through seamlessly from Gaucho to Nightfly, and it was only, I guess, a 2-year wait or something like that. So it didn't seem like it didn't seem that bad, until then Donald, hit writer's block, and then things got really quiet for a while. And I was always kind of keeping my ear to the ground and hoping for signs of life, and eventually found Metal Leg, and got friendly with Pete.
What is metal leg for those? I mean, I think a lot of my listeners know, but just in case.
Yeah, well, metal leg was a classic zine. You know, you don't hear that term much anymore, but a classic stapled together indie kind of basement fan zine. And Pete Fogle was just so thorough in reaching out to anybody connected with the Dan. You know, they would engineers, musicians, anybody, and he kind of stitched together this history of the band, and kind of kept tabs on them, and legendarily had something to do with stirring the pot enough that they decided to start doing those dates in New York, and which led to, you know, the whole revival. And it kind of dawned on Becker and Fagan, I think, at that point, oh, people still give a shit. Maybe we should do something.
So you actually credit Pete for kind of instigating the reunion ultimately?
Well, I wouldn't say he did it single-handedly, but I think he and the little community around the magazine,
right,
had something to do with showing the two of them, especially Donald, that people missed them, and they weren't just a kind of blip on the radar, that there was this kind of ardent missionary group of fans out there that was just waiting for the next Dan droppings, whatever they were, even if it was just a club date with some friends.
Yeah, for sure. Did you get a chance to go to any of those like Rock and Soul Review shows by any chance?
I did not, but I was at Madison Square Garden in 93.
Wow.
And went to the after part, Pete's after party at La Barbat, and met Drew Zing, who now I work with pretty regularly, and met Becker that night, and met a bunch of people whose names I knew from Metal Leg, and, you know, could put faces to those names. So, and there was no Toronto show on that tour, which is why I came to New York.
Really? How was that MSG show?
Oh, my memory of it is just like ecstasy from the downbeat to the end, honestly. And you know, they, if you look at the set list to that show, they were doing a fair bit of stuff from Cam and Kyriad, because that was the new record.
Yeah.
And so that was fun to hear that stuff. And it was a version of the band that would never fully recur, either with Warren Bernhardt on keys and Erskine on drums, and Drew as the lead guitar player.
Right. Love Erskine that. And Drew only were in it for that 1 year, I think. And then they.
Yeah, that's right.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, they've, you know, there's been, especially in the early going, they had a fair bit of rotation in that band, but I really liked that version. Of course, I love and know some of the new version of the band that's, I guess, technically been around much longer than the original Steely Dan was at this right. point. Do you know the 33 and a third books?
Oh yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's a great series. Actually, I didn't know who you were when I first, like, I hadn't heard your name when I first read the Asia book, but that was one of the first ones I read.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I, just being a general music nerd as well as a Steely Dan nerd, had read a few of them, and they had done maybe three rounds of them or something, like 30 plus books at that point. We're talking about maybe 2006. And of course they had done some of the usual suspects, Sergeant Pepper, and I don't know, I can't think what else, Physical Graffiti, and Are You Experienced, and I don't
the
know.
Ones that are always on every list.
Yeah, know. Exactly. Certain, Blonde on Blonde and
the canon.
Blah, blah, blah. Right, the canon. Yeah, canonic rock and soul albums. And I was like, when are they going to get around to doing a Steely Dan book? And so I naively, thinking I could make a difference, tracked down the name of the series editor in New York, and called him, cold called him, and he actually picked up the phone at his office, and he said, "Hey, how can I help you?" And I said, basically, in so many words, "Why haven't you guys done a Steely Dan book in the series yet?" And he said, "Well, why don't you write us a proposal and maybe you can do the Steely Dan book?" And I said, "Fuck yeah."
If only it were that easy, but I guess it was.
Yeah. They still do it this way now. They take each time they're going to do another round of books. I don't know how many they do at a time, 5 or 10. They take submissions, and if they think the submission's well written, I guess, and maybe the album fills a hole that they need to fill in terms of keeping the series balanced, they'll let you do it. And people from all walks of life write those books, you know, like I think it was a film guy wrote the first Bowie one. But anyway, I just thought, okay, yeah, I'll write an Asia book, and I get to just write a like 200 page love letter to my favorite record. What could be bad about that? But then it occurred to me, well, if this gets approved, I might be able to do interviews with some people. And of course, the holy grail for me was talking to Donald. And and that was quite a process. I had to go through Irving Azoff's office, and I zeroed in on this poor guy, this assistant who heard from me like a dozen times over a several month period. And I just I would not let it go. You know, I was just that guy who pops up in your email every day and you go, "Oh shit, what am I going to do about this guy?" And so he brought it to Donald once, I believe, or maybe to Azoff or somebody in the office. And the vibe was, we want to make sure that he's not going to ask dumb questions. Like you were saying earlier when we were first talking, you know, where did you meet Walter? What do you write first, the lyrics or the music? And the, you know, those kind of Wikipedia level daily newspaper style questions. Yeah. I said, just make sure that you know that Donald knows that I'm a musician and I want to talk about harmony and arrangements and sidemen on that record and production and the nuances of songwriting. And I won't ask him who Ricky was or any other dumbass things. So finally that got through to him, and maybe they had run it up the flagpole for him more than once. I'm not even sure, but he relented and said, "Yeah, well, I'll do an hour." And so, you know, I just hit the roof. I'm going to go talk to Donald Fagen for an hour. Are you kidding me?
Wow.
And, went to his office on the appointed day, and I was nervous, you know, because those guys were supposed to be super prickly in interviews. But I think part of that is when it was the two of them ganging up on somebody.
Get into their kind of almost comedy routine where they were taking the piss out of the interviewer, like whether they knew it or not. You know, they would deflect the question and go off on some, you know, tangent as a way to avoid actually answering it. But
yeah, or they would just try to make each other laugh and put out a little piece of misinformation and see if the reporter would actually believe it. So, you know, I'm knocking at the door, and he buzzes me in, and I look up the stairs, and there's Donald Fagen looking down the stairs at me and says, "Hey, Don, come on up. You want a cup of tea?" And then from then on, it was just smooth sailing. Like, we got right into the nuts and bolts of making that record. And he was, you know, funny and full of information. And we ended up talking for more than double the time that they had allotted me. So I felt like I kind of hit the jackpot.
Just the two of you in his office?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, did you think it was absolutely essential to interview Donald to get you know, the information for your book, or was it just like, hey, I'm writing this book, maybe this is a chance where I can get the chance to interview my hero?
Yes. Both are true.
Right.
Because, you know, it's hard to find. If you read articles about the same band, you get the same information a million different times, and you never really get into the weeds of songwriting or arranging or, you know, how they pick musicians or what happens on a Steely Dan mix date and all that kind of stuff, you know. So that stuff I genuinely wanted to know and felt like there was no way to know it other than to go to the source. But of course, it was also a good excuse.
Yep. That's amazing. So you got to interview your musical hero. So in terms of getting into the weeds, you know, what were some of the, you know, things about songwriting that you were really trying to hone in on in terms of structure, harmony? I mean, like, give an example or two, maybe.
Well, you know, we talked, for example, we talked specifically about this harmonic device that happens in a bunch of places on Asia and really doesn't happen on their other records that I can think of. You know, the Deacon Blues interview where intro where it's stepping down in half steps, the harmony, and then, you know, jumps up a whole tone and then steps down again in semitones. And that's very much like the intro to Peg. Like, it's pretty much doing the same thing. And then there are smaller increments of that occur elsewhere on the album. So I brought that up and he addressed that specifically and said, you know, they had always thought that moving something down in half steps was sort of corny. And that's kind of like the My Parents' Music did that. And he cited a couple of old tunes that had it.
You mentioned that in your book. You said that, like,
yeah,
there's a chord on Katie Lied that kind of comes up, and it's on like Bad Sneakers, yeah, and Your Gold Teeth, and you know, that's the chord that maybe people thought of as corny because it was something that you would only hear in the pre-rock era.
In the rock era, when you wanted to play like the home chord for a key, you would just play a major chord. But certainly when Becker and Fagen were growing up, there were a lot of instances where somebody would play a major sixth chord instead. And there was undoubtedly a period where that felt corny, but I don't know, somehow by 1977, when they started busting it out, like on I Got the News, there's a whole bunch of that. It felt fresh again. So, you know, that was the kind of thing that I could talk to him about, you know, and he, I guess after a few minutes of the conversation could tell that I knew enough about that to speak to it, you know, with some fluency. And so he didn't have to sort of hold anything back, and he could sort of nerd out on chord changes.
You proved to Donald that you knew your shit and that, you know, yeah, he was in good company to, you know, really.
Like, yeah, well, it felt like that anyway. Like it felt like he was a little guarded at first. And then once we got to talking about specifics, he just warmed up to it and was full of stuff, you know, specific to all those songs.
Anything else specific that Donald, you know, that's from your book that, you know, was specifically something that Donald imparted to you that you recall? I know it's been a while, but
yeah, it has been a while. So it came out in 2007, and still sells well. Incidentally, I'm always tickled when I get a royalty statement every 6 months, and it's, you know, the Dan community is still
stronger
there
and healthier than ever.
Yeah, now, exactly. So. I really think that it is.
Yeah.
But let's see. I mean, well, I had specific questions like on the double verses on Deacon Blues, the second half always seemed bluesier than the first half. And it was because Donald knew this. He knew exactly what I was talking about and said, yeah, that's because I got Tom Scott to do the horn charts. And he added a note. He added the minor seventh to the chord on the downbeat on the second half of that verse. And suddenly it had just a different color. You know, and then he had stories about different sidemen. You know, he had the whole rap about Bernard Purdy coming in and kind of nailing it on the first take, and how, you know, they didn't use click tracks because Bernard was a click. You know, they would give him a tempo, and he'd count it off, and they'd play down the tune. And even if the tune was 6 minutes long, they would check the tempo at the end, and it was, you know, like within one click of where they started. So that's pretty special. But he, you know, we talked about, you know, Bernard would be putting on his overcoat after one take, going, "Derek, you got it. The guys can play to that." And yeah, they're like, wait, we don't even know if that's how the song's going to go yet, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But what one anecdote about while we're on Sidemen that I really thought was great was he talked about how they got Wayne Shorter to play on the title track. And that happened through Gary Katz. He knew somebody who knew Wayne and kind of went after him that way. And Shorter agreed to do it. And he came in, and who knows what he knew about Steely Dan at that point. You know, he was sort of on the Mount Olympus of jazz musicians by then. So maybe he knew nothing about them. I don't know. But came in, and they showed him the chart for Asia, and he took a couple of runs at it, and he went, just give me a minute with this. And they stop recording, and Wayne gets out a pen, and he takes it over to the piano, and he's looking at all those changes in the solo section. And, you know, he's making notes on a piece of manuscript paper, and was at that like a good long time. And then they did some more takes, and it was instantly, you know, great and worthy of the record. And they were getting stuff that ended up in the mix right away.
Yeah.
But I love the fact that when you hear about somebody like Miles Davis or Wayne Shorter or Bill Evans or whoever it is, just being a mere mortal and being challenged by something and going, yeah, you know what? I have to do a little homework on this. Because, you know, people imagine that those guys just descended from heaven knowing everything. Mm. And I thought it was really refreshing to think of Wayne Shorter's got to kind of woodshed this tune before he records it.
You know? Yeah.
Great friend of mine, Steve Armour, who's a phenomenal musician that I know from Berkeley, made the point about Becker and Fagan that they're kind of in the tradition of the great jazz musicians of the 50s, in the sense that a really important skill that they had making all those records was that they were great band leaders and great at figuring out who should be in the room for what song, and, you know, who belonged kind of inside their worldview and who didn't, you know, which that specific idea hadn't really occurred to me, but
the worldview of the song itself, the individual. Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, knowing who's going to render those ideas properly and sound like they're the guy to do it. And, you know, there, you can argue that a Larry Carlton, who's had a long and spectacular career as a recording artist, maybe the two or three best things he ever recorded were on Steely Dan records. And, you know, that's not by accident. That's because someone gets you in the room and puts the right thing in front of you and says, play on this. And maybe on your own records, you, without even intending to, you go toward your comfort zone, and you're not always challenging yourself the way an outside band leader would. You know, if you listen to Cannonball Adderley on Kind of Blue, like Miles was asking him to step into some stuff that he hadn't before. And you know, that's maybe the most exceptional playing of his ever on a record. So that's sort of an underrated skill in the modern era, where everybody's supposed to be an auteur and everything sort of springs from the mind of the creator fully realized, which is sort of a hangover from the singer-songwriter era. But, you know, prior to that, a big part of it was like, who's going to be in this band, you know?
Yeah.
Like Coltrane and Elvin and McCoy, you know, those magic kind of things that get stirred together.
Well, that's why they were constantly shuffling the lineups of the songs and the albums. I mean, from the interviews that I've done, you know, that's one of the things that people always tell me is that, you know, they'd bring in a band and they'd have them play together. And if it wasn't working, they would say, well, it's not working. And they, you know, shuffle it up and try a different band. So,
right. And then the extraordinary thing about that was the people they were bringing in to try were, you know, top people who were on a million records and were getting triple scale to be in the room that day. And they still felt no kind of compunction about saying, yeah, that's not making it.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. Yeah. And it's funny, your Larry Carlton example is great because, you know, he's all over the Royal Scam. He's on like most of the tracks. And I feel like something about his guitar playing fits the personality of those songs more. Like, I understand why they used Larry for that album and not Katie Lied. Like, Katie Lied to me, the songs on that record don't feel like Larry could have, you know, I think he plays only on one song on that album. And that, to me, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, that's right. Scam is his record. And you listen, I mean, listen, think of what the song Kid Charlemagne is about. Kind of a legendary drug dealer on the run. And then listen to the joyous sound of that guitar, especially on the tag. I mean, yeah. The middle section is the one that everyone focuses in on, but the tag is something special too. And just the contrast between the that soaring guitar playing and this kind of tawdry subject matter. It's great. I love the Randy Newman quote was on that topic was, I love when beautiful melodies are telling me terrible things. My brother Jeff and I wrote a book for St. Martin's Press called Precious and Few: Pop Music in the Early 70s. And they said we signed to write this book and eventually did a sequel to it too. But they wanted, if possible, somebody to write a foreword for it, somebody of note, you know, so that there was a known name on the front cover instead of our confusing German last name. And so of course we approached Becker and Fagan, and that happened. That was through Pete Fogel because it was something to do with Gary Katz and Donald, you know, had this joint venture called River Sound at the time. And
this is in the 90s, right?
Yeah, in the 90s. What year would it have been? Maybe when we were writing the book, it was probably 94, 95, somewhere in there. And lo and behold, they agreed to do it. But interestingly, they latched on to, we had described in our little blurb about the book, this is sort of a compendium of Watergate era pop music. And we're kind of going through it all and talking about funk and reggae and prog and all this stuff that was going on at the time. But they latched onto that Watergate thing because they'd had their run-ins with G. Gordon Liddy back in Bard College days, which
my old school.
Yeah. And so they did this fantastic, hilarious, snarky, spoofy kind of, three or four page thing all about the Watergate era and how it affected rock and roll and putting little sidelong things
really
about Liddy and stuff. here's the heartbreaking part. We were hitting the roof, the fact they even agreed to do it. And then when we got, it was back in the days when you would receive all this stuff by fax. So this fax one day starts going coming out of my machine. I realize it's a carbon copy of something that Donald and Walter wrote. So we brought it to our editor in Triumph. Great editor, by the way, Marion Litzy. She's now with Penguin. And she said, okay, let me take it to whoever needs to look at it, and we'll look into, the ins and outs of having it be part of the book. About a day later, she called us and said, I have bad news. So St. Martin's Press, which is, I don't know, one of the five biggest publishing houses in North America, was deep into a lawsuit having to do with Watergate at the
Oh,
time,
wow.
to the tune of, it might have even been hundreds of millions. Like, it was a really big thing from something they had published, and they were temporarily forbidden from publishing anything to do
Oh my God.
with Watergate. And we were begging her, like, come on, this is only in a very
It's satirical,
peripheral
right?
way. It's clearly satirical, and it's peripheral to Watergate. And these are not people who were involved in it or have, any axe to grind. But it did not fly. So to this day, I have a piece of three or four pieces of fax paper in a folder, and that's what became of that.
So
So.
that's never seen the light of day, that
It
folder.
never has. Maybe it will. I feel like I would have to ask Donald if it was okay before I
Fair
let
enough.
anybody see it.
So through your project, through Monkey House, you've played with, I mean, obviously your music is extremely influenced and inspired by Steely Dan. I mean, are you
Yeah.
recognize that and maybe
I recognize it and can't help it. I mean, I think everybody writes music based on the kind of menu of stuff that really got through to them in the early days. And for me, a lot of that's Steely Dan. And I think that there's a lot of stuff that doesn't sound influenced by Steely Dan because people can't handle the tools that it requires to be in to sound influenced by them. You sort of have to have some jazz under your belt, and someone in the room's got to be able to arrange the thing for a larger ensemble and that kind of thing. So I mean, it's a different skill set than launching a Rolling Stones tribute or something.
Definitely.
But yeah, so and I sort of feel like, why should those guys have all the fun and be the only ones who get to use those chords? I want to use them too.
Yeah. So is it mainly in the chords that you're influenced by them or other things as well?
Well, I would think that I'm influenced by them in ways that I probably don't even know about or can't fully articulate. But I mean, I just know that I just know when a song is sounding finished, and it's not sounding finished until it's really been, massaged and lovingly edited and mixed. And I think I like the kind of hybrid Steely Dan technique of, I have a core rhythm section now, a four piece that is my Monkey House band. But then, we have outside soloists come in, we have different horn players on every record, different features come in. So I sort of got that. You're allowed to mess with the recipe every time out kind of philosophy.
Who were some of your other influences, if you don't mind sharing?
Oh, well, I guess in the songwriting realm, it's Joni and Paul Simon, and I think James Taylor's in there, and probably people that are sonically a little more akin to Steely Dan, like Boz Scaggs and Mike McDonald, and then of course Beatles. I mean, anyone who doesn't tell you that's an influence is just lying. And then, you know, stuff that was around when I was growing up. My dad actually went to school with Burt Bacharach, so we heard a lot of Burt Bacharach
They went to
around our.
school? Where?
Yeah, Burt did his Bachelor of Music at McGill University in Montreal.
Wow.
Yeah, not
That's
well known,
amazing.
but
Did your
yeah,
dad
no,
know him personally?
knew him quite well. Yeah, like went on a
Kidding.
couple of road trips with him and played piano together and
That's
all that
amazing.
stuff. So Bacharach, and then, you know, those 60s songwriters like Jimmy Webb and Carole King, and you know,
Yeah.
that's all in there, I'm sure.
Cool.
And hopefully I've got some ideas of my own too.
That's the hope, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a constant conversation on here is just about like, people who are, influenced by them and how do you get the Steely Dan sound and, is it possible to do it? And because it's such a specific combination of elements. And your book goes through all the different, their approach to writing lyrics, their production techniques, their, obviously all the, the actual musical ideas that are, very specific to them. So yeah, that's.
Yeah, I think the lyrics is often the place where those things fall down, actually, because you can marshal all that harmony, and you can put trained studio people in a room, and it's all going to sound good. But if your lyrics are trite or light or kind of off the mark, it's instantly not Steely Dan,
Yeah.
because they gave just as much of a shit about that as about everything else.
Well, it's the lyrics and the way he sings them that kind of tempers everything else going on. Like something about that blend is what makes it work. If you take that out of it, then the formula falls apart for me. So.
Yeah, that's right.
To each his own, truer words were never spoken.
My brother and I write songs together, and around 02 or 03, we started doing shows in New York, mostly at Joe's Pub, although we've done Birdland as well and a couple other places. And we would just sort of put a house band together and have maybe sometimes as many as 8 to 10 vocalists in the course of an evening, going through and singing our stuff. And those over the years have included Catherine Russell, Carolyn Lenhart, Jamie Lenhart, Vicky Cave, and Michael Lenhart's always been in that band whenever he has been able to make the shows, which we don't tend to do them in the summer, because everybody's on tour. So he's probably done three quarters of them. So by the time I started doing the kind of modern era of my project, Monkey House, I knew those people. And so Mike's played trumpet on the last four albums just as a guest soloist.
Yeah.
And in fact, he's within the next couple of weeks, he's cutting a solo for the new record. And I think I've been working just about the same length of time with Drew Zing. And I actually can't remember how I first got to Drew, because by then he was long out of the Steely Dan fold and had moved to San Francisco and was playing with Boz. And
He only did one
he's,
year of Steely Dan. That's it.
yeah, that's right. There's a story behind that, but I'm going to make you ask Pete about that.
Okay.
But yeah, and so then eventually I moved to LA, kind of in the middle of that period of Monkey House Records. And a pal of mine, Brian Pearson, who works with Inside Music Cast. You know Brian? No? Okay. He's, based in the Midwest, but knew Jay Graydon. Knows a lot of people, Brian. But knew Jay Graydon and said, hey, well, if you're moving to LA, I got to lay your stuff on Jay Graydon. And so he sent him whatever was my most recent CD at the time. And Jay said, yeah, man, this sounds great. This guy gets it. You know, tell him to make contact when he gets here. And so it was pretty close to when I was moving out there. So a couple of months later, I'm phoning Jay and saying, hey, man, it's me. You remember Monkey House? You know, that kind of awkward, like, you wonder if that kind of went in and out of his consciousness in 48 hours or something. Yeah. But no, he remembered and had me over. And when I was down there for those 10 years, we did just a ton of writing. And in fact, co-wrote one song for one of the Monkey House records that Jay plays on. But I was just sort of blown away always to be there in his inner sanctum, where a lot of records got made, you know, at the kind of peak of the LA scene. And the first time I was in there, I said, look, Jay, I don't want to nerd out too much, but can I hold the Peg guitar?
Yeah.
So he took me into his guitar room where there's, you know, 30 guitars hanging up, and showed me the red Peg guitar.
Yeah.
And the other kind of nerd moment, the first time I was over there when we were actually writing, you know, we were sitting on the same piano bench and he's got a guitar and I'm sitting at his grand piano. I said, hey, Jay, who else has played this piano? And he said, oh, you know, Stevie Wonder, Herbie Hancock, Burt Bacharach, David Foster, just rhymed off about
not
eight names
bad.
That were
yeah.
all. Yeah. And I was like afraid to touch it after that.
Yeah.
But we really got to be good pals, and he's said nice things about my stuff, even when I wasn't in the room over the years. So
that's
that was
cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
And then we had an album called Left in 2014 that I got Elliot yeah. Randall to play on.
I listened to that track today.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool. That's great.
I think it sounds like him.
Yeah,
you
for
know,
sure.
It's recognizably an Elliot Randall kind of melodic solo with a bit of that's kind of, I don't know what to say about his sound, like this kind of brittle but somehow warm sound. It's a neat trick he's got. I mean, even reeling in the years, that's a very crunchy guitar sound, but
right.
somehow it just is it's warm and round at the same time.
Sure.
So yeah, I certainly have enjoyed you know, having all those people involved in the records over the years, and touched that they think it's worth doing, and it's worth keeping doing.
You want to challenge my philosophy?